This is an interview with Joseph Kaufman, who was Dean of Students at the University of Wisconsin from 1965 to 1968, became president of Rhode Island College, and now is back here as a professor in the Department of Educational Administration. I'm interviewing you because of your key role in the Dow affair. You came here as known to be, I believe, the most liberal dean of students in the United States, but after Dow, I gather you had lost your effectiveness or lost the confidence of the students, and so that you eventually left, and there was even, I gather, a Joe Must Go slogan circulating. And yet I know that you were looked upon with affection by students. The Cardinal had a nice editorial about you and Bill Sewell in July of 1968, saying that you were the wrong men for the university at this time. I don't know that you remember that, but it must have been a very painful year for you, and I would like to have you talk about how it came about and why it came about, and give your impressions of people and events from 10 years' vantage point. To begin with, would you just say something about your own background, your the kind of atmosphere you were raised in, politics and that sort of thing?
Well, I'll be glad to try to respond to that. I'm dying to get back to your statement before asking me my background question.
Fair enough,
but I'll wait. Well, I grew up in Massachusetts, born in Rhode Island, grew up in Massachusetts, went all through public schools there during the 30s, graduating from high school in 1939.
What was your father?
My father had a grocery store, a meat market, and my father died when I was 16 in high school. I had two older brothers and two younger sisters. And times were rather difficult financially in the 30s, as one would know. And it was unrealistic for anyone in my family, at least, including my two older brothers and myself, to think of college in those days. There were no public four-year or two-year institutions in those days in the Massachusetts area, other than some normal schools, which were quite distant, and which only offered teacher training, and not a bachelor's degree, for that matter. So that I was raised in a kind of nose-to-the-grindstone, everybody in the family work in order to make a living kind of environment. I would say no particular politics in the family situation, although I was always personally identifying myself with the oppressed and the victims, particularly the European situation at the time. And I did have my father's family, his mother and several sisters were left in Europe, and my father was an immigrant and came here when he was about 15. So that I did lose some family in too on my father's side. But politically, all I can remember is being upset with Father Coughlin's anti-Semitism on the radio in the late 30s, and being very pro-FDR, and being aghast at the newspaper stories about what was developing in Europe with the Nazi regime in Germany. I helped support the family by working in the store when I graduated from high school with an older brother, and I was very interested in music as a young person, and throughout high school and after was involved with dance bands including a stint for about a year and a half of being a vocalist, a crooner in those days.
Really?
With dance bands, and which is the way I earned my living. And in fact, I left singing in New York with a dance band at Roseland Ballroom, for that matter, in order to enlist in the Army in 1942. Since those days, and I was a GI Bill student beginning in the fall of 1946 at the University of Denver, where my wife's family had moved. Since those days, I would have to identify myself with liberal Democrat political activity and philosophy dating back to those post-World War II days. Mm-hmm. And I've never been interested in running for office as such, but I always tended to be helpful to people who were in the liberal Democrat side, and did serve in the Kennedy administration.
That was your Peace Corps job.
Yes, mm-hmm. And helping set up the Peace Corps, and I was responsible for training of all Peace Corps volunteers before they went overseas.
Mm, yes, that would be interesting. I wish we could discuss it.
Yes,
here,
that's another, another topic, yeah. Obviously. So I think that answers the...
Yes,
if it doesn't,
it does.
Please
mm-hmm.
ask.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Can I get back to your
yes?
Your introductory comment about Tao and so mm-hmm. on, and what did it feel like? Obviously, those were very difficult years, particularly, I think, 1967-68 up through about 1970, for anyone who had any position of responsibility and authority for the welfare of an institution. And I think that was probably true for government, mayors, college presidents, deans, etc., in that authority was being challenged everywhere, and anyone who attempted to maintain order and maintain social institutions was obviously in the way of some people who were intent on not having business as usual. So it was very difficult, and it's difficult not to take some of that personally. In terms of feelings, I was always accused of being soft on students and bleeding heart type for the underprivileged, etc., all my life. And I did serve as Dean of Students, the first Dean of Students at Brandeis University in the 50s. And just before coming here in 1965, I was the consultant to the American Council on Education on the matters of students and student mm-hmm. services, and had in fact convinced them to pay more attention to college students and put together their annual program in 1965 on the college and the student, just before coming here. So I was known as an advocate of students. My first two years here, I was on the program of the National Student Association and so on,
yeah.
And student
yes.
rights. And
well, your writings
sort.
Are very
my writings
very
were
good and clear
along
on that.
That line and so on. So obviously it was very difficult for me as the anti-war protests escalated. I don't know how much detail you want to go into.
Well,
on,
I think
this whole
I
area.
Would do want to go into some detail, and this, by the way, speaker is very good, so you
okay.
can, you know, have to get close to it. You spoke in our preliminary interview about the state of the organization of the whole administrative structure when you came, mm-hmm. and Harrington was just becoming president. Would you want to? Mm-hmm. Was that a factor? Do you think in how affairs developed, or who was in charge of what?
Well, first of all, I think it's important for me to state my clear view that what happened in the late 60s in terms of anti-war protest disruption and some violence I don't believe had anything to do with how the university was administered or who was administering it. I cannot think of a university more open, more free, more benign than this institution in its hospitality to every point of view, no matter how radical, militant, etc. I think what occurred was a reflection more of what was going on nationally and, in fact, internationally at the time, and the fact that those forces coalesced in such a way that explosions occurred, which I don't think one could trace directly to how an institution was administered. In fact, the most conservatively administered institutions had the least disruption, protest, and so on. The most liberal institutions had the greatest difficulties because they were open. So obviously, if one wishes to talk revolution and to cause disruption in an institution that backs off from saying no, one is going to have to escalate events pretty high in order to cause that kind of incident. And I think that's what we had here. So that in 1965, we had very vigorous protests and sit-ins, and they just kept escalating as we accommodated them and rationalized them and defended them until we did reach the point of violence when there was willful obstruction of university exercises, university events, and so on. But let me get back to your question. I came here in June of 1965. In 1964, President Harrington had become president of the system, which included Milwaukee and Madison and the development of, on paper at least, of UW-Green Bay, UW-Parkside, which had been approved by the legislature, and several of the two-year centers, so that the university had moved to a central administration, and Robin Fleming had been appointed in 1964 as the first chancellor of the Madison campus. His title that first year was provost, later changed to chancellor. My actual title was dean of student affairs rather than dean of students, and that was significant in that there was concern both within the faculty and the Board of Regents that more attention be paid to the fragmentation of student services, the lack of coordination, the lack of leadership really in the whole student affairs area, and they had really created a division of student affairs, putting together everything pertaining to students, from the union and residence halls to discipline and campus police and so on.
Now, Lubert was dean before you,
but
is that
was,
right?
He was, his title was not dean of student affairs.
Just dean of students.
I was the first one with that title.
Mm-hmm.
When I came here, Ed Drake, who was counseling psychologist, director of the counseling center for many years, and was in his early 60s at that time, was acting dean of students. He had succeeded Ted Zillman, who had been dean of men, and Martha Peterson had been serving as dean of women. Luberg was prior to them.
I see.
And Luberg had been put on Fred Harrington's staff when went into central administration in a kind of community relations alumni affairs role.
Mm-hmm.
So that when I came, Luberg was still here, as was Martha Peterson, who had moved up to Fred Harrington's staff as a student affairs person for central administration. And I came with a clear understanding on the part of the regents as well as the faculty committee that brought me here, that there would no longer be a separation of dean of men, dean of women, and so on, that I would be dean of student affairs, and all matters pertaining to all students would be coordinated through my office.
Mm-hmm.
So I came here to build up student affairs, to give it leadership, to try to establish better relations with students and so on, and was seen in that mode by Chancellor Fleming and the faculty and student government leaders, the Cardinal and so
mm-hmm.
on, if one looks back to those
years.
I had
right,
very
yes.
effective relationship with the Cardinal staff and with the WSA offices and so on in that first year. Obviously, student politics, including points of view of WSA and the Cardinal, changed in the succeeding years as the anti-war protest became more vitriolic and militant and so on, not only here but throughout the country.
The staff that you had, did you appoint them, or had they been there, the people who were your assistant deans?
Well, several people were already at the university in various capacities, union staff and so on. What I did was I asked Jane Moorman, who was then with the counseling center as a counselor, to come up to Bascom Hill and Bascom Hall and be assistant dean of student affairs.
Had you known her?
No, but I interviewed some people in my when I was considering taking the position, and I knew that I needed someone. She was a counseling psychologist, and it was crucial to me that I find someone who wasn't afraid of students. This is a pretty overpowering place, and particularly in 1965 as the national headquarters of the anti-war movement and
yeah,
so on.
It that's
was
an interesting statement.
Particularly, I think, overpowering to certain kinds of people who were used to the old, good old days.
How did you find out whether they were afraid or not?
Well, I talked to a number of people whom I felt had the qualifications to assist me in the dean's office, and selected her on the basis of those interviews and some of the references of faculty and staff, including some of the people in student psychiatry and health service and so on here, someone who would not take aggression personally.
Oh, I see. That's what you
who
mean.
Had the kind of stability and insight and so on to be able to deal with difficulty. I also, in that first year, set out to recruit a male. We had done away with dean of men, dean of women, and I wanted to have two assistant deans and one woman and one man, if possible. And I recruited Eugene Klingon from the University of Missouri to come here and also be my assistant.
Now, had you known him before?
I had known him at professional meetings, and I asked people around the country who was a good dean of students type, dean of men type, and recruited names of a number of people, and met and talked with a number at national meetings of deans of students, and invited Jane Klingon to, as a result of that search, invited Jane Klingon to come up for interviews with the staff and so on, and then hired him and brought him here. Tragically, he died of a heart attack at age 49, about 6 months after I left in 1968, and was himself in the cockpit that I had left, taking a lot of that pressure and I guess punishment, one would have to say. So I brought in Jane Klingon from Missouri, Jane Moorman, who is now the head of counseling services at Berkeley. I brought in my next year, and I can't be sequential here because I'm really dealing with one topic at a time.
Yeah,
so in terms of staff, I also, Ed Drake was reaching age 65, and I asked him to step down as director of the counseling center and had appointed a search committee and brought in Randy Thrush as director of the counseling center. I also asked Porter Butts at age 65 to retire as director of the union, although to remain involved. And,
you asked him to?
Yes.
Hmm.
And although he wasn't too happy with that, that's what occurred, and I ran a search committee and recommended to the chancellor the appointment of Ted Crabb as the director of the union.
This was just on your own authority entirely, because Board of Bus
was all of this was on all of student services, including the union, residence halls, mm-hmm. etc., were under the dean of
But I mean
affairs.
Porter Butts is a different category altogether, being a long time
yes,
here.
Very and young. I obviously negotiated consent with the union directorate, and, including the students and the alumni, including Mr. Frauci and others. And
Lowell Frauci, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah.
And well, obviously, I acted in concert with duly authorized committees, advisory boards, etc. I did not mm-hmm. just do this capriciously on my own.
Did Sewell agree with this?
I
think it happened during
well,
his...
Porter Butts was in my last year, 67-68, I mm-hmm. believe, and Sewell was chancellor then, although the resignation had been worked out in concert with Chancellor Fleming.
Oh, I see.
So Sewell agreed with the appointment of Crabb on my recommendation, mm-hmm. but he was not involved in the decision to have administrators retire at 65. That is something I worked out with Chancellor Fleming, who agreed to it.
Was that partly in order to have a reason for asking Porter Butts to leave, or?
Oh no, there's nothing personal about it, about Porter or anybody else. I felt, as did others, that including the professional staff in Counseling Center, Memorial Union, and other services, that administrative units really should have some kind of cutoff in terms of their leadership, that at some point younger staff ought to know that there was a chance to get ahead. People ought to not feel that they could control their agency or their department as long as they lived, that there'd be some kind of expectation that at a certain stage administrative heads and Chancellor Fleming agreed with me in terms of deans there ought to be some expectation that one step down from major administrative posts at some cutoff point. And although the faculty could and still can go on till age 70, there was no understanding at that time about administrators. And in talking about this with the chancellor, we agreed that this would apply to deans as well. And as you know, since that time, major administrative posts are now down to 62, including chancellors.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, no, there was nothing whatsoever that was personal.
Well, I say that because I gather that he had been rather difficult to deal with towards the end, and I...
My guess is, and I'm going to be 56 next month, my guess is that the closer one gets to 65 or 70, the more difficult one is to deal with. I think it is true that one doesn't like to spend much time planning the next 10 years or assuaging the feelings of a 35-year-old staff member that wants to know whether he has a future or she has a future. And I think there are problems with people who go on indefinitely. I think the vitality of their organization suffers unless there's some understanding that that they step down when they are still fairly vital
mm-hmm.
and new kinds of leadership take over. So I think that applies to everyone. I think it's understood here now as policy for all the major administrative heads, including all the deans.
Yeah, I see. Well, to get back to your appointments, none of the names you've mentioned are ones that crop up in connection with Tao. I don't want to be. We're not talking just about Tao, but
no.
Peter
well, what
Bunn
you should understand is that that Peter Bunn was on the staff of the Office of Student Organization Advisors with Elmer Meyer as his assistant. Elmer Meyer went on the next year to Cornell. So I had Peter Bunn on my staff. I had Joel Skornicker on Peter Bunn's staff.
I see. Mm-hmm.
I had Joe Corey as my assistant director of Foreign Student Office. And of course, Newell Smith was director of residence halls at that time. I created the housing office and moved Newell Smith to that. On the assumption that housing was more important than just residence halls, and put residence halls under that, because we only housed about 6,000 of our 37,000 students, and it seemed to me that we ought to offer more housing services than merely residence halls, and that office and others were later wiped out in 73 in the economy move here. But all of those people were here. I made Peter Bunn my administrative assistant in the first year before Gene Klingen came in, and later made Peter Bunn head of the Office of Student Organization Advisors, which was Alma Meyer's post. Mm-hmm. He had gone on to be Dean of Students at Cornell. Joe Corey, with my support, got a Ford Foundation grant to do his... He had to do field work in Africa to get his anthropology doctorate. And I helped him, along with Bob Clodius, helping him to get a post in Nairobi as a visiting dean of students at the university there in Nairobi, Kenya. So he was overseas when... the big Dow 2 event occurred. Joel Skornicker was on that staff. Emily Chervenick was the placement director, because Ralph Hansen was new about 6 months before me. And
that's right. I didn't know that.
Yes, Ralph had come about 6 months before me, and we have since become very close. But obviously, being told that campus police would be considered part of the Division of Student Affairs whenever they dealt with student matters, and not the fire and safety and night watchman matters, was a little awkward at first. And he attended all my staff meetings and involved me whenever there was a question of what role the campus police should play in any particular difficulty that was arising. So almost all of those people that are still here were involved. I altered their positions, but I did inherit a number of them in various roles within the university.
Mm-hmm. And who were the people, the sideways people that you worked with? That is this Cleary and...
Well, okay, now let me get back then to Harrington being central administration, and he was in the office in Bascom Hall that is now the Chancellor's office. The Chancellor, then Robin Fleming when I came, was in the office that is now the Vice Chancellor's office. As you, to the left as you enter the center door of Bascom. When I came here, Fleming was in his first year. He appointed Jim Clary, who was out of the speech faculty and was the parliamentarian for the faculty meetings and so on, appointed Jim Clary as assistant to the Chancellor for academic affairs. And he also hired from Washington, although I did not know him in Washington, Robert Atwell, who was named assistant to the Chancellor for budget affairs, budget matters. at the end of my first year, when the title was still somewhat in flux in the chancellor's office, and he had started out as provost, and when central administration was beginning to shake down and step out of Madison business, Chancellor Fleming changed Clary and Atwell's titles from assistant to vice chancellor. So you had Clary as vice chancellor for academic affairs and Atwell as vice chancellor for budget. Chancellor Fleming did give me the opportunity to change my title, since I was on the same kind of line of reporting directly to the chancellor, to vice chancellor of student affairs, but I chose not to, since I also so you had Clary as vice chancellor for academic affairs and Atwell as vice chancellor for budget. Chancellor Fleming did give me the opportunity to change my title, since I was on the same kind of line of reporting directly to the chancellor, to vice chancellor of student affairs, but I chose not to, since I also functioned as a kind of dean of students, and I also felt that the title dean had a historical authenticity to it,
vice chancellor
didn't, and
hazy.
So I retained it, mm-hmm. although after I left in 68, Chan Young's title was made vice chancellor. Mm-hmm. That office again, we'll get to that perhaps,
yeah.
was later wiped out in 1973. So I worked very closely with all the academic deans and with Clary and Atwell and Fleming, and when Fleming brought me here, it was with the assurance that I would have day-to-day direct involvement with him and be involved in all policy matters. I knew that it was a no-win job. After all, I started the position after the Berkeley free speech movement demonstrations and so on, and there was a great deal of unrest in the country, student unrest. And it was clear to me that large universities were going to be very difficult places. They had grown so rapidly, and people were worrying about faculty-student relationships and depersonalization and so on. And in fact, I had written and spoken out about this nationally, so I knew what I was doing. Back that spring, in April, before I came, the New York Times did an editorial based upon a speech I had given, in which I was very critical of faculty for having withdrawn from more involvement with students.
Well, that's interesting, because I know you made that point later on.
Yes, and so some faculty were not too sure about me, since I seemed to be critical of faculty when I came here. My criticism of faculty was essentially that they had seized every opportunity of their own, and in many ways students, particularly undergraduate students, had been abandoned to each other and to teaching assistants. And so this was essentially the point of view that I brought here, knowing that it was going to be extraordinarily difficult, and so on. So Chancellor Fleming, in enticing me to come, assured me that I would not be expected merely to keep the lid on and so on, that I would be an integral part of policy making and so on, and I must say in all candor that he never let me down in that regard. Of course, anyone in the chancellor's position in those days had to be spending about half of the time worrying about student matters, because they were getting rather difficult, and relations with the board and the community and the legislature and so on were very often about students and student behavior. People were not yet used to long hair, let alone
yes, that's right.
Some of the other things that
occurred. It's hard to remember now, but it certainly is true.
I could tell you about some of that first year or so, or those first few months, and the kinds of issues and the kinds of controversy in which I got involved.
Well, I would like
students.
Just to have you place where Harrington. In other words, you saw Fleming pretty much daily, did you?
Yes.
Uh huh. And what about Harrington? Did you have much to do with him?
Well, Harrington had, of course, brought me to the attention of Fleming, And so I knew Harrington from my national involvements. But I did not report to Harrington, nor did I see him except casually until we really got into very difficult times in 67. I did not. Harrington and his staff attempted to peel off from Madison Matters. They were busy with the system budget, with the development of the Green Bay and Parkside campus, with the development of two-year centers, the international involvement of the university, and so on. And as controversy developed, President Harrington publicly took the position that he wanted strong chancellors, and he was not going to be interfering in the day-to-day business of the Madison campus. And when the chancellor felt that it was necessary to involve him or consult him, the chancellor would do so, but that he was not about to second-guess or try to run Madison campus. So President Harrington or someone on his staff, primarily Bob Taylor in those days, attempted to keep informed so they could answer questions from the press and the legislature and the regents, but to keep informed rather than to attempt to make suggestions as to how we ought to be operating.
So it wouldn't have occurred to you to go to President Harrington to discuss any...
No, and in fact, it's hard for me to convey this to you, perhaps, but I was regarded as about as knowledgeable a person in the area of college students as anyone in the country, and was sought out by
no, that's
by
clear.
Others.
Mm-hmm.
And so their attitude was that your judgment on this is better than ours, your experience and so on is better than ours, so we have to rely on you, and we have confidence in you, and you know, you tell us when you need us, but otherwise we're not looking over your shoulder.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have to clear a decision that, for instance, the regents or the legislature might fuss about it.
Well, I've always been very sensitive in my perceptions of the effect of decisions on others and how they're perceived and so on, so that I guess my own instinctive way of operating is to try to prepare people for decisions and have them understand them so that they'll be able to realize why what was done was done. So in that sense, I guess I always try to anticipate by informing people that there was going to be a story or that I had dealt with something in this way and there may well be questions about it, and here is why I did what I did so that you can answer questions.
No, would you talk to Taylor about this, or
no,
just to tell him what was going on?
Or? Essentially, I dealt with Fleming and our own news bureau in Bascom, which was for the Madison campus. I'd say that Taylor tended to touch base with me and with them rather than the other way around.
I see. Mm-hmm.
I never felt that I ought to consult. Now, I'm of course talking about 1965, 66.
Yes, I understand that. Yes.
I'm not up into the particular Dow demonstration of 67. There are really two in 67, the Dow 2. I'm not talking about that.
Yeah.
So what we have is, for example, my first... week or two here, I have the Milwaukee Journal and the Wisconsin State Journal and others asking if I would grant them interviews, and it would never occur to me to get permission to do that or to discuss with anyone what I ought to say. I had a very responsible position in Washington and felt I could deal with these matters without any involvement, and that's the way I operated. I was invited to speak at a lot of groups in the community and the state my first few weeks, and I expressed myself very forcefully, as I have some clippings which I could show you, urging faculty to
to resume the more traditional role of the student-faculty relationship, and worried very much about alienated teaching assistants and so on being the only source of adult interaction for new students and undergraduates and so on. Meanwhile, I set about to try to improve the quality and accessibility of our services and to try to get Financial Aid Office to coordinate its activities with housing and with admissions and with registrars so we didn't have people getting all sorts of fragmented messages and deadlines and instructions as though we couldn't deal with them as people but only in terms of these various functions and bits and pieces mm-hmm. and so on. And I think we were quite successful in that first year. In that, I believe it was October of my first year, I was approached by NBC News. I guess we were about in the fifth or sixth week of the new school year, and asked if I would speak on camera. Tom Pettit was the Huntley Brinkley person that was on campus, and he wanted to talk to me about how we were going to cope with the anti-war protests and so on. We were the national center for that. And I had had no real experience with that on this campus up until that time. It was my second month, really. And I said, certainly, and they lit the lights and turned on the camera and asked me if, as best I can recall, if I thought some communist influence and the anti-war protests that were going on. And I said, to my knowledge, no, that I knew of no evidence of that, even from the FBI, and that, in fact, one of the things that surprised me were how few students were engaged in anti-war protests on this campus, or any campus, and that I thought young people ought to help participate in shaping their destiny, and that I felt that the war was a good illustration of pernicious forces at work and so on. And he was very grateful to have that on film. And when that was aired, I got a number of comments from people, some of the more liberal faculty applauding me and some others being not quite certain that I was the right person for the job. In that I really said that I thought more students ought to be concerned about the war and what was developing and so on. So this is the way I was perceived, and I was very much sought after by liberals and even the new left for a while as someone who wasn't anti that kind of thinking. So I spoke to a number of church groups and civil rights groups.
When you say by the new left, particular organizations, you mean that
well, no, I couldn't. You can't characterize the new left organizationally. There were, I guess I'd say, like the liberal caucus among faculty, among students, among faculty wives, among, you know, et cetera. I was perceived, in other words, as sympathetic to the rights of protesters and our obligation to provide a place for them to meet and speak and hear whomever they wished and to protect their right. And in that sense, some people felt I was fairly radical compared to the way deans of students, at least around here, traditionally acted.
Yes. Did any of the people in the administration regret you saying that? Did you have any feeling that they weren't with you? Some of them.
I never got the feeling that Harrington or Fleming were the slightest bit constraining on me in this regard. I do know that some faculty and some administrators wondered about me in those days, that maybe I was being, you know, too liberal. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I did have this image of being, and I was, you know, I'm being somewhat facetious, but the words were actually used in connection with me, being soft on students. That is, I was nurturing those who wanted to express their discontent, and I was sympathizing and empathizing with them. And I felt that this was important. I did not feel that our intelligent, sensitive students should be scoffed at for having these kinds of feelings. And I was perfectly prepared to make their concerns part of my agenda, part of my activities. I thought that I always made clear that there had to be certain boundary lines on this in terms of the rights of others. But of course, we never really get into that until 6 or 8 months later, when we had our first major protest demonstration, which was a sit-in in the Peterson Administration Building, which lasted for 8 days and eight nights, and the end of that first academic year that I was here. And I found it necessary there to insist on two things. One, that the police not break it up forcibly if the protesters would respect the guidelines I had to develop with them, which was that they could not prevent people from doing business in that administration building. If they insisted on blocking the corridors and the doors so that no one could go in and out of offices, that I would have to permit the police to forcibly remove them. If they, however, respected the right of access of people to do business there, that I would ask the police not to eject them. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they could have publicly in the press and elsewhere a vigorous demonstration, make whatever message they wanted to get across, and I would tolerate that so long as they did not violate the rights of others.
Who did that? Do you remember which students you dealt with
at that particular time?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to have difficulty with that in terms of my memory.
Well, I shouldn't ask you because
I would have to dig into old records and so on. I can remember bringing the six or so leaders of that into Fleming's office to negotiate an ending of it. Incidentally, it went on about 3 days longer than they really needed to, but they... they wanted network coverage of it, and I believe it was CBS in Chicago asked them if they could wait about two more days till they get a film crew up here, which is what they did.
Goodness, that's quite a long time to wait.
That's right. It was rather difficult for us. I don't recall the names of the individuals, but again, these were people, you see, who they were. This was over the resurrection of the Korean draft regulations, which threatened to take away the 2S student deferments based upon scoring on an exam or rank in class, which of course cut across everything from athletes and fraternity kids to whoever. So it was a fairly popular kind of revulsion, and it wasn't merely an ideological one. But I had no difficulty in communicating and negotiating, despite the vigor of the protest, communicating and negotiating with the leaders what the ground rules were going to be, and in keeping the campus police respecting those ground rules. Now, obviously, we took a great deal of heat from the press, and particularly from the legislature, some regions, who thought we ought to just throw those scruffy characters right out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the days, of course, when people talked about spineless administrators and so on, and didn't even begin to understand the nature of the problem of mass disobedience, or the court decisions of the early 60s relating to civil rights protesters, which effectively restrained public officials such as myself from summarily expelling, punishing anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Even the people in our legislature, our own lawmakers, were unable to comprehend that we couldn't just throw people out and discipline and so on, that they didn't even begin to understand the rights of due process and so on, which had been developed out of some of those trials of civil rights protesters in the South.
Did legislators call you?
I'm trying to think in terms of my memory. I don't recall individual legislators calling me. I do recall contacts that were made with the president's office, which were then communicated to me in terms of how do we answer this, or why did you do that, or what is going to happen next, or something of that sort, largely of an informational nature. I would have to say, with the exception of one or two regents, that I never really felt anyone telling me, look, you know, if you want to keep your job, you better crack down or something. I never felt that. And I know that when Dow 2 occurred, the conventional radical assumption was that people such as myself, people such as Bill Sewell, were being, you know, told what to do, our bosses from the other end of State Street or whatever. And that just isn't true. That isn't that you don't perceive pressure, but there wasn't that kind of thing. You just almost have to, people have to almost make up, believe in the good guy, bad guy kind of fantasies, that, you know, someone like myself, you know, just wouldn't involve police or wouldn't say no to their side if I wasn't being ordered to by Wall Street or yes, some, you know, some oligarchy.
Just the way the other side assumed, right, they were all communists. It's the
right
same.
And mm-hmm. I never really felt that. The thing that I, the wavelength I was on at all times, right up to and including through the Dow 2, was that I had a deep obligation to protect the integrity of the university, the integrity of the academic enterprise, if you will, that if I ever took the position that might makes right, or coercion of whatever attitude or idea or view is permissible, that something very precious would be lost, and I really wanted no part of being an officer of a university where we winked at one another and clobbered somebody. I felt it was very important to protect the integrity of the university, and that's the wavelength I was on. Now, that meant that if you wanted to have a radical communist speaker, that by God, I would arrange a place for you to hold a meeting, and I would defend it to the public, and I would have police protect you and the speaker. And by God, if a year later one student wanted to go in and talk to a representative of the National Security Agency about a job, and we had a placement service that allowed any employer and any student who wanted to talk to an employer to hold such a discussion, that if necessary I would protect you and have police protect you and the building and so on, that you had a right to access to this public university, no matter what your view was. And that if we ever compromise that, anything liberal would be lost. That I always felt that the right had a lot more strength than the left. And that once you can rationalize that if you don't like an idea, you can snuff it out, prevent it. Once you rationalize that force is the weapon to be used when you don't like something that's going on in the university, you don't like an idea or a viewpoint, I felt that you don't really have a university any longer. So this is the Greek tragedy. Nature of Tao was that those of us who were defending the integrity of the university as an open forum, a place where any idea may be discussed and expressed, were being portrayed as being for the war, as though there were the forces against the war and the forces for the war. Well, I don't know of anyone, myself, Bob Fleming, later Bill Sewell, etc., who were for the war. What we were trying to do was protect the integrity of the academic institution, including the position that the faculty had clearly taken.
Now, that's what I would like to ask you about, because that's a very crucial thing, is that faculty decision after the first time,
right,
that interviews should be, placement interviews should be held on campus, because at that point it was certainly open to the faculty and to decide that they wouldn't be.
Right.
And I'm wondering how you felt about the decision. You wouldn't have been voting on it, of course, but how
I was a voting. I was a
you were able to vote? Oh, I see.
On tenure.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, then you were. I know the vote was 11 to 1, I think. I mean, 11... what's the word I want? 11... The strength of the vote was 11 to 1. The ratio was 11 to 1.
Of the faculty?
Yeah. And I'm curious how you...
Well, obviously, one has some ambivalence about being told to... we are going to defend the front lines, and then you're the one that's supposed to go out and defend them. So obviously, I knew that some of the... As things escalated, I knew that some of the positions were going to be difficult, given the vigorousness of some of the protesters. But I never doubted the basic philosophical issue
of having
that was being decided here. That is anyone going to set themselves up to judge what ideas are going to be permitted, or what people are going to be able to discuss, or with whom one might converse? And I think everyone overwhelmingly agreed, certainly I did, that you don't really have a university if you set up some authority to decide that, even no matter how benevolent you may think that authority is to decide that. We also ran polls with the student body, which overwhelmingly asked to have the placement service retained as it was, open to whomever students wanted to talk to. That is, no employer had a right to be on our campus if there was no one that wanted to talk to that representative of an employer. It was only if students signed up in advance seeking to talk to the personnel representative of one of those agencies or companies. And the service was to enable the student to have that conversation, not the other way around. Once you question that and say, well, we'll have to decide who you can talk to about what, I don't think you have a university anymore.
What I mean is that, well, for instance, Bill Sewell voted against that, and there were others, because evidently in New York, for instance, all the placement interviews were held in hotels.
Voted against what?
That motion to have placement interviews on campus. I wondered if you had considered the possibility of just having them off.
I don't know what you're referring to. You're referring to after the Tao incident.
The first Tao, the faculty considered the question of whether future placement interviews should be held on campus or off campus, and they voted to have them on campus. but the vote was 11-1, as I say, a ratio of 11-1. But there were some who thought they should be off campus, and I just wonder if you entertained that notion at all.
No, my own view would be that the reason for having them off campus would be totally one of having been coerced. If one could do that, you're in effect saying placement as a student service for the convenience of students really takes second place. If a student service is controversial, then maybe we have to do away with it. And it seems to me one could go on and say that there's no justification for having health services on campus. After all, we have a big city here. One could say the same about counseling services. One could say the same about housing services and so on. Why should the university provide space, staff, and so on for anything?
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that the whole integrity of student services was being put in jeopardy solely because of coercive factors that were operating. And I thought there was an important principle involved.
Well, so you were voted with the majority on that issue, obviously.
Yes, and of course, being responsible for placement. I was also reflecting the views of the faculty committee on placement services and the staff and so on, and I certainly agreed with them and defended and interpreted their position.
So you were voted with the majority on that issue, obviously.
Yes, and of course, being responsible for placement. I was also reflecting the views of the faculty committee on placement services and the staff and so on, and I tried to make sure that the people who worked here in placement saw their responsibility as serving students, not employers.
We have a bit more. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have your views about some of the organizations that were getting underway, the Committee to End the War in Vietnam and SDS and the Committee for Direct Action. They were getting under, well, of course SDS was older, but getting underway in 65 and building up. How much you had to do with them?
Well, essentially the only relationship that we had was in terms of booking rooms to meet in and of conveying to them time, place, manner kinds of questions which all organizations were expected to respect. That is, when and where you could use loudspeakers, when and where you could hold meetings and so on, the fact that you were to register in advance when you wanted to use a room or an auditorium, book a facility and so on, since there was limited space and many organizations. So the only dealings we had in those early days were essentially conveying the time, place, manner kinds of regulations and assuming that they would respect those. So in those early days, it was the Office of Student Organization Advisors, which Peter Bunn and Joel Skornicka were working in down at the Union, with which most of the contact were. And that contact was essentially of, we want to do this, what are the ground rules kind of thing? Or we want a big room, or we want to hold a rally, where can we have it? Or we want to have it here. Is there any problem? And essentially, these were arrangement kinds of matters.
Reasonably amicable,
entirely? at the beginning they were reasonably amicable, yes. There was no attempt on the part of the university to prohibit or to attempt to deny access to anything. And it was only in 1966 when we began to get into difficulty with some individuals more than organizations in the union, in particular in the open recruiting area where people could put up card tables and so on for everything from the young socialists to the join the Navy. And it was at that time in 1966 when small groups or certain individuals began to challenge the right of people they didn't like having space to distribute their wares or to show mm-hmm. things to students, and in fact began to disrupt or remove literature and so on that was out there, and challenge the idea of an open space. But again, it was fairly amicable. It was all dealt with through standing, duly constituted committees. The union directorate had its policies about the building, and we had various committees within the university that could deal with these matters, at the beginning at least. It was only beginning in 1967, really, that the more radical groups, and radical's a poor term because nothing wrong with being radical. What we had was the beginning of a development in which some small groups, most of whom were free-floating, that is, they would not identify as having formal leadership with which one could communicate, when such groups would self-constituted and never were quite sure, they didn't, in other words, they didn't have constitution and offices and so on, would take it upon themselves to refuse to accept the duly constituted authority of the university, whether they were faculty student committees or the union directorate or a disciplinary board or the board of regents or the government or whatever. They just refused to accept any duly constituted authority as being legitimate. And once you had that element developing in 67, you of course had no way to have rational negotiation about ground rules, guidelines, and so on. And that did develop later.
So that would be separate from the SDS, or it might be people who were members of one of these
when
groups.
SDS first started, it was it ran meetings like any other organization. Mm-hmm. By 1967, however, it was difficult to find out who the officers were or to talk with anyone. And I don't know what SDS was by 1968. It would be difficult to find it as a formal organization because the tactics changed. For Dow too, which is when we had the violence. The tactic that was used was no one was authorized to speak in the name of the group, and therefore no one was authorized to communicate with the administration. Therefore, it was not possible to discuss with anyone what was going to happen and what the university would tolerate and would not tolerate and so on. That was the tactic that was used.
Was that for fear of being outlawed by the Student Senate, which I understand was an issue for a while?
I think it was a clever tactic, which if you are calculating a way to avoid any negotiation or co-option or cooperation with authority that you declare as illegitimate, by refusing to deal with that authority or name anyone as your leader, you obviously have created a situation where you have kind of an anarchy, a shambles, yes. And there's no way to deal with it, no way to hold anyone responsible or accountable or even to send a letter to someone.
Well, there were Martin Tandler, do you remember him? He was the
vaguely
president of SDS, I guess, in 66, 67, and then Henry Haslack in the following year. Did you know either of them?
Oh, yes, and I certainly knew Haslack. You have to understand that as in those 3 years, student leadership changed dramatically. In other words, I had the president of the student of WSA helping me try to cope with the sit-in.
That was Fullwood, is that right?
Well, when I first got here, it was Don Siegel, then Fullwood, then
Gary Zweifel.
Gary Zweifel, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only in the latter year, 67-68, really, when we get into a complete turnover in both WSA and the Cardinal to people with whom I had no relationship. But people like Don Siegel, Mike Fullwood, Gary Zweifel. Well, Zweifel, when Fleming and I were held so-called captive in my office, February of 67, for several hours, Zweifel insisted on being beside me and telling the SDS and other people, whoever they were, and, you know, mm-hmm. can't really characterize them by an organization, that they were not speaking for the students, and was assuring Fleming and myself that student government was not sympathetic to this kind of tactic and so on. That was February 67.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, who was SDS? What was their, what were they, who did they represent? Who, you see, very often they were self-appointed people who would tell us that they were SDS. I mean, no mm-hmm. one ever elected Evan Stark to anything. What was their, you know, if they had followers, they refused to recognize formal student government anyhow.
Yes.
Or any duly yeah. authorized. So it was very difficult to deal with some of these people. But I remember Tandler vaguely. I do remember Haslack fairly well.
Did you deal with him in advance of that, the first hour? Did he come to your office? Well, I guess there was a sit-in in your office, wasn't there, before
well,
the...
Well, that was... So you're talking about February 67.
Mm.
And that resulted from some arrests that had been made on the engineering campus. But I'd say that Haslack and Robert Cohen were probably the leaders of that first Dow demonstration.
Yes, mm-hmm. And Zwicker, Bob Zwicker.
And Zwicker. I can't remember all of those names offhand.
What were your impressions of them? Do they merge together, or do you see them as different?
Oh, I think they were all individuals, and they all were coming from different directions. You know, I think it's very hard to characterize protest leaders as it is deans or professors or anything else. I'd say that they ran the gamut from very sincere, fairly well buttoned up people who had an ideological commitment which was somewhat revolutionary, all the way to quite disturbed people psychologically who were in and out of treatment and had difficulty controlling their impulses and loved the excitement of shrieking at authority and bringing down whatever could be brought down and everything in between.
How would you characterize, say, Robert Cohen? On that?
Well, I'm going to find it difficult to engage in easy characterization of individuals because I think, you know, I have a professional kind of role and a certain kind of professional training, which I don't like to make armchair clinical judgments and so on, but I would say that, and so I'm not going to be very profound in my characterization. I don't want to get into clinical kinds of things. I would say that certainly both Cohen and Stark, well, maybe I better separate them. I think Cohen was very eager to have a leadership role and was essentially self-appointed, although he was quite effective in whipping up a crowd. Considered himself kind of an erudite theoretician of the left,
mm-hmm.
and adopted a kind of Lenin type dress and hat and beard and so on. And I guess I would have to say that it is my view that he was quite unstable during the time I knew him. There were times, for example, when he would sit in my office and bum smokes from me and almost cry about how bad things were going with the left, and he seeking my kind of support and sympathy all the way to telling me that I would be one of the first to be hanged when the revolution succeeded, which might have he might say to me a week later. I don't want to divulge things that I know that are I think professionally sacrosanct. I just don't think it's proper for me.
But I would
at the time that I knew him, I would have to say that in many ways. He was brilliant, and but in many ways also a very unstable person.
And Evan Stark?
Evan Stark paid me a visit my first week or two here because I had been dean of students at Brandeis University, and had a reputation there as being a great liberal, also. Friend and advocate of students, and he was, I guess, a sophomore there when I left, and so he knew of me, certainly, and I had been involved in his admission there and so on. And interestingly enough, he had gotten himself in great difficulty there right off the bat as an undergraduate over the issue of obscenity in the student newspaper and things like that. So I had had some recollection that he was a difficult kind of person. Within my first year here, I had had we had had some complaints. He was a TA, and his use of obscenities in the classroom with freshman girls caused some parents to complain about him, and that had been brought to my attention as a problem that no one was quite sure how to deal with.
Excuse me, when he came to see you, was it his, was it?
Oh, it was friendly. He wanted to let me know that he was a resident demagogue. In fact, those are the terms he used, uh-huh. that he was having fun rabble-rousing. Uh-huh. And he used the term that he was playing demagogue and so on. Again, I regard he a very, very bright, energetic person. In retrospect, though, I must say that I regard him as someone who had certain elements of instability, if not psychopathology, involved. And I don't use that expression to put him down. It's just that I think it important to note that there were certain kinds of people for whom the excitement of causing a crescendo of difficulties, of a crowd, of excitement, and so on, played a more than normal part in their motivation. And I would have to put him in that category. He loved that kind of thing, and my guess is that it wouldn't make any difference what the issue was, if he saw a way of getting people excited about it, that's what he would do. So, for example, Robert Cohen got his bigger kick out of causing a protest over the one wrong way bus lane, as he did over, you know, the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. It was if you could find some way to challenge the authority and get people to turn against the establishment and so on, you got your kicks somehow.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I have to be careful because I don't want to trivialize the issue involved in the war in Vietnam. And yet one is always in danger of doing that. But I always felt that anyone who was against that war and in effect preached violence was no peace advocate. I think you have to separate those whose conscience was gravely disturbed by the war and who operated out of a framework of a resolve for peace from those who saw the war or the bus lane or the bridge or the whatever, the drug bust, whatever, as a means of whipping up a frenzy to cause some kind of a revolution because everything stinks and they're kind of nihilistic. And I want to separate those two, and I'm obviously caricaturing positions. But I think the people got mixed together here, and I was always advocating publicly with faculty and everyone else the need to separate who we're talking about here and to make sure that what some call the crazies and so on were not lumped together with those who felt they had to bear witness to it was abhorrent behavior on the part of our government, mm-hmm. and the military.
Would you make a distinction between the two of them as to the amount of idealism involved in their behavior?
Well, I don't know how to, they wrap themselves in idealism, so I don't know how to characterize. Yeah,
I have heard that it's said that Cohen was much more idealistic than if that's the word to use, that the war was more of an issue to him than it was to Evan Stark, and I just wondered if you would agree with that.
Yeah, I think that Cohen had a record of at Michigan before coming here, even of being caught up in the anti-war movement. I think Stark was, even by his own words to me, kind of playing and enjoying playing the role of demagogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he could use almost any issue and he would still want to play that role. And, you know, if it upset an 18-year-old girl to use certain four-letter words to shock her, and he got a kick out of that, and then we get a kick out of daring you to do anything by citing academic freedom or something, it was his whole approach really was kind of daring everybody,
yeah.
and baiting everybody, and so if the war protest was one thing, and it could have been protests about many other things. Yes, I would say that, but again, I want to be very careful not to trivialize the issues involved by saying that the people were disturbed or something of that sort. I think it's important not to do that. But I have no doubt in my mind that many of the knee-jerk kind of protesters who were emptied out of the Rathskeller or Mifflin Street or whatever without even knowing what the issue was, because they were just called to come, we need your bodies, that many of those people were in and out of psychological and psychiatric treatment, unfortunately the excitement of the protest seemed to be part of their activity they look forward to.
Yeah. Well, what about Hank Haslack?
Well, I never knew him that well. I always regarded him as more of a fairly disciplined, ideologically oriented person rather than... He certainly was, in that sense, a more buttoned-up person than either Columbus.
That's what you mean by buttoned-up.
I think he was a much more disciplined individual and probably more motivated by his point of view rather than by some of the impulses and energy of the moment. I don't think he was as swayed by the excitement as some of the others who would get carried away, really.
So does this mean you trusted him more in talking
to
him?
No, I don't know. Trust is not a good word here, I don't think, because I always dealt with everybody on the same assumption. I mean, I never really dealt with anyone on the assumption that I had to say things other than what I meant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I meant that you could, if he said he was going to do something or not going to do it, that you could believe him.
This is 9-10 years back, and I 10-11 years back, I have difficulty recapturing a feeling about a particular individual. I just don't know how to answer that.
Yeah. Okay. Really, what about Bob Zwicker?
I never had the feeling that Bob Zwicker was caught up in any particular ideological way so much as was a difficult person and an aggressive, fairly hostile person who found in the Times as a lot of people did a way to vent that kind of aggression and hostility in a socially acceptable way with his peers. I never felt that he had any particular leadership ability or any particular ideological drive. He was kind of anti kind of person, and a lot of those people found an escape in the so-called movement. They could trash and call themselves patriots. They could hurl obscenities and wrap themselves in some noble cause and so on. And I there are a lot of people like that. I always felt that Zwicker was more that I could characterize him, more in that vein than in a leader or ideologue vein.
Mm-hmm. The name Don Bluestone is very prominent at that time, but he must have left the campus because he... Do you remember him at all?
I don't recall him at all.
He was in the committee to end the war in Vietnam.
See, there were... one has to be so careful to separate the anti-war people from what turned out to be the people who were willing to fire and bomb and throw rocks at people and so on. There's a big difference, and it may have been radical and militant to be against the war at a certain time, but then using the terms radical and militant to include the Zwickers and the people who are willing to engage in violence and set fire and so on
does a great injustice
to the people who really were bearing witness to their conscience.
Can you think of examples of students who would purely fill that particular slot?
Oh my!
If I have any other names to mention, that. This John Coatsworth is another name that comes up.
Well, I think he was. I think he was a very effective New Left ideological leader. who was effective in it because he was very disciplined. Mm-hmm. And so he wore a jacket and a tie and kept his hair looking neat and spoke politely, even though he may have been the toughest and maybe even the most ruthless foe. But he was prepared to do business on your ground. Yeah,
I often wondered why more than didn't realize that
right.
was the most effective way to...
And I think he was probably one of the toughest of all these people.
Hmm.
But if he stood up and politely asked if he could have the floor at a faculty meeting or something, the chances are he would be granted because he would do it politely and
yeah.
say please, and he might, using good language, excoriate the faculty's integrity more than any of the
mm-hmm.
scruffy ones. But yeah, I think he was very effective in that regard. But you see, my own views here about people, I have difficulty with that. I tried never to personalize, you know, how I felt about the people with what my responsibility was. And so I never really attempted to carry, you know, I'm kind of having difficulty
yeah.
characterizing these people for you because I never did that. I never tried to size up someone in terms of, you know, where they were coming. I tried to force this to be as reasonable and rational as possible. So, you know, if you want to be for some cause which I may abhor, my feelings have nothing to do with it. We're dealing with, this is the university. Now we have time, place, manner questions. You know, if you want to do that kind of silly thing, then it has to be in this area where it's not going to disturb anyone, and it's got to be between classes or in the evening, and it's got to be, you know, how many people are coming, what kind of security will we need, rather than, oh, what do you want to do that for? Recognizing these people for you, because I never did that. I never tried to size up someone in terms of, you know, where they were coming. I tried to force this to be as reasonable and rational as possible. So, you know, if you want to be for some cause which I may abhor, my feelings have nothing to do with it. We're dealing with, this is the university. Now we have time, place, manner questions. You know, if you want to do that kind of silly thing, then it has to be in this area where it's not going to disturb anyone, and it's got to be between classes or in the evening, and it's got to be, you know, how many people are coming, what kind of security will we need, rather than, oh, what do you want to do that for? I don't agree with it. I never allowed myself mm. to be in that position.
It would be an important discipline to have.
It's a very... See, that kind of role is utterly professional if it's done well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what I was trying to do. And I felt that I was being... You know, I felt that I was a senior officer of the university with an implied kind of oath of office to conduct the business of my office in a way that would stand up to any kind of examination.
Mm. I have one other person, Paul Soglin, who's...
Yeah, that's very interesting because, you know, the landmark federal case which everybody studies and reads about, which affected public institutions, was the Soglin et al. Versus Kaufman et al. Case in federal courts. My first contact with Paul Soglin was, I guess he was graduating in my first year here. He graduated in 66, I believe. And Peter Bunn, who was acting as my administrative assistant, I recall asking me if I had any objection to his recommending Paul to law school because he was borderline and was going to have trouble getting in. And he had asked the Dean of Students Office, I guess, to write a letter of reference for him. And I didn't know him, really,
mm-hmm.
Although he was active in WSA that year.
Yes.
But I didn't really know him. He wasn't president of the student government. And I said I had no objection, and Peter Bunn did write such a letter.
Peter Bunn knew him, I gather.
Well, yeah. Well, Peter Bunn knew all the WSA leaders because Peter was working in that office. And also because Peter was familiar with the people in the law school. I, in my time at the university, Paul Soglin was never warned, disciplined, or involved in any activity that would bring him to the attention of the university authorities as in violation of anything. And although he made clear to people, I guess, that he was against the war, a lot of people were, to my knowledge, he was never involved in anything at the university that would be questionable.
He's always called a leader of the radical movement.
Well,
The
Soglin Kaufman case is it has to do with Dow too. In October of 67, and it came about by 10 students with Soglin, law students. I guess most of them were law students, not all of them. In advance of the Dow demonstration, requesting a federal court, Judge Doyle, to issue an injunction restraining the university from acting on a statement that I had made, warning that willful disruption of the interviews some days hence would result in discipline.
That was your October 10th statement.
Right. And the reason for that statement, if you want to know, I can make very clear to you for this tape, because it follows from what preceded it the previous year, an obligation that I had, either I or Chancellor Sewell had, one of us, to make such a statement. But the suit, the attempt to get a restraining order was thrown out by the judge, and I guess it was thrown out the day that Dow 2 occurred. And then the plaintiffs kept amending this, and eventually they were challenging the disorderly conduct statute of Wisconsin, and they were attempting to prevent the legislature from issuing subpoenas in their investigation. And it was a very complex kind of issue, which ultimately resulted in just about everything they requested being denied, except the use of the term misconduct as being subject to vagueness. And Judge Doyle ruled that that the university would have to, in the future, have specific rules on prohibitions of behavior such as throwing rocks and assaulting people and so on, rather than the general term misconduct. And however, held that the university had the inherent right and responsibility to maintain order, and did not question the disciplinary actions that had been taken on the basis of that inherent right. And so the result of this case, which is what makes it a landmark, is that all the public institutions in the country were in effect told that if you want anything to stand up in court, you better have specific rules and regulations and consequences for violation, much as one would have in a criminal code. And that's the significance of the case, which is very significant, because I never opposed to having specific rules, nor did the university really. But Soglin's name associated with that case makes everyone assume that he and I were locked in mortal combat or something.
You probably never saw each other, did
you? No, I never had any dealings with him that I can recall. And I know that I never had any dealings with him which related to discipline.
Was he the leader of his name is associated with it, but was he the one who sort of kept moving, or did the whole group, or he must have been just a beginning law student at the time?
Yeah, he was in his first year of law school at the time. I don't know. I think where his image comes from, aside from that case, is running for alderman from the Mifflin District And obviously one has to wrap oneself in counterculture, street people, anti-war, militant, etc., to be elected in that district in the late 60s. And I suppose he did probably give the police a hard time on a couple of occasions.
He was arrested at the bus lane, isn't it, I think.
You know, open when they would have block parties and things of that sort. So I don't in any way want to put him down for his whatever activities occurred later, but during my time here, he was one of dozens and dozens of students who were active in political activity, student government, and so on, and never, to my knowledge, was involved in any disciplinary action or even of a warning nature at the university.
He, I think, founded the whether it was a party, HELP, you remember that?
Well, every year at WSA, there are new parties formed, and he may well have been. But certainly when he was active and student in WSA, WSA was not a very radical body. They certainly welcomed me here when I came, which would have been his senior year.
Yes. And you did make the statement once that you were available to elected representatives of the students. I imagine your meaning was that you, people who wanted to deal with you, should deal through that, through the Senate.
Right, and I also, regularly try to meet with student leaders. I wanted them to know me as a person. I would meet them for lunch, and sometimes we would have all of the offices together for dinner or something of that sort. I have had, until my last year here, people like Gary's wife and Mike Fullwood, people like that, Dave Knox, who was the president of the union director, and so on, would come to my house for supper and so on. Acquainted with my wife, et cetera. It was a normal kind of dean of students, our kind of advocate, interference runner, kind of supporter, guide relationship with student leaders. It wasn't until my last year when the concept of co-opting and non-cooperation and denying the legitimacy of administration or faculty and involvement in student life and all of that stuff became that all of that broke down.
Yeah. On that statement that you issued, did you consult with Sewell or Harrington or anyone about issuing it? I mean, why did you decide to do it at that time?
Well, okay, let me explain that. It's very important, I think, that one understand that. You recall, we didn't have faculty senate in those days, not until 1970, so this was faculty as a whole, plus standing committees of the faculty. The first document that's crucial to understanding this is Faculty Document 122, which is March 6th, 1967. Now, this is after the first Dow demonstration, which Fleming, who had come down to my office to meet with some of the protest leaders, Fleming and I had been, in effect, held captive for several hours. We succeeded in getting them to agree to move to the large auditorium so that everyone could hear the discourse between us, since in my office no more than 40 or 50 people were jammed in. Everybody else was out in the corridor. And it was I, incidentally, that suggested to Chancellor Fleming that we bail out the students who had been arrested that day.
Oh, really?
And I offered to put up half the money, and he thought it was a good idea and decided he'd want to do the whole thing himself. But it was my suggestion.
Glad you got that in.
And we had not intended for any arrests to occur. Those had occurred outside of our purview, really, that really occurred over the engineering campus, where we were not physically able to witness anything.
Mm-hmm.
But on the faculty meeting, which occurred following that Dow One, which there had been some arrests and vigorous protests, but no violence.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a succession of escalating incidents. Previous one, the Senator Kennedy's speech was mm-hmm. disrupted in the stock committee and so on. At that meeting, March 6, 1967, faculty document 122 was distributed, which was a statement by Fleming, Chancellor, which talks about when Senator Kennedy's speech was made impossible in the fall of 66, the faculty enacted legislation designed to prevent such incidents in the future. And then he cites that policy
yes.
statement that had been made. Students may do this and may do that, but by lawful means which do not disrupt the operations of the university. And then Fleming said to the faculty, during the week of February 20th, 1967, disruptive actions took place in connection with a pre-employment interviewing of the Dow Chemical Company. Some students were arrested, etc. On Thursday, February 23, I reported on the situation to the faculty and indicated that if the above provision of Chapter 11 be enforced, that is, you couldn't disrupt the university's operation, this might require not only campus and city police, but possible additional forces. The faculty voted that the rules must be enforced.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, okay, I discussed this with the university committee and so on, and I shall try to see that the campus administrative machinery operates within the following guidelines. And then he restated the guidelines that he and I created for that Dow 1, February 67 mm-hmm. demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
No picketing or demonstrations which do not block or occupy offices or interfere with classes will be permitted, and so on. And it was a very liberal kind of interpretation, it seems to me. Well, Fleming left at the end of that year. The opening faculty meeting of 1967 with Chancellor Sewell in his fourth week of office started with these remarks by Chancellor Sewell. Our students are greatly concerned with what they perceive to be injustices. Some are very active in mounting protests and demonstrations, etc. Great universities have always been places of energetic contention and dispute. Would we have it otherwise? This faculty, by tradition and the laws and regulations of the university, have vigorously supported the constitutional rights of students to freedom of speech, peaceable assembly, petition, association, etc. And goes on to reiterate the openness of this university mm-hmm. to dissent. I trust that we will never deny these rights. We have, however, this is Chancellor Sewell, October 2nd, 1967. We have, however, held that support of causes must be by lawful means which do not disrupt the operations of the university, even as we are prepared to examine and discuss with students the purposes of university operations which they may question. My predecessor laid down general guidelines for the enforcement of this principle, which this faculty accepted and which I believe are fair to all, parentheses, faculty document 122,
mm-hmm.
which I just
mm-hmm.
read to you. Until such time as the faculty acts to change these guidelines, they will be followed. We will continue to protect the integrity of the university as an educational institution in an open democratic society. Now, this is Chancellor Sewell on October 2nd. 1967, knowing that the Dow interviews are part of a placement interview scheduled for later in October. Okay?
Yes.
Well, when the students mounting this protest handed out leaflets saying, we move from protest to resistance, join us on October, whatever the date was, 19th or 20th, we will block the Dow interviews. We will prevent them from occurring. It was obvious that, and we could not communicate with anyone. There was no leadership willing to be identified. There was no one willing to say, you know, I'm the spokesperson for the people mounting the protest. And in fact, it was a calculated, if you read that Scotton report, you'll see it was a calculated tactic to, in fact, they said that anyone who purports to speak for us will be disavowed, so that no one could be dealt with.
Oh, yes, I remember Peter Bunn goes quite
right
in his report to you.
Then what we had here was an open avowal purposeful, willful obstruction, disruption, and so on, which Chancellor Sewell had just informed the faculty that he could not permit.
Mm-hmm.
So it became incumbent upon us, given the ethic of due notice, that is, of telling people that if you continue to do that, I'll have to arrest you, of giving fair warning, incumbent upon us to say to the students who might be caught up in this, you can't do that without there being, you know, some penalty. Who was to do this?
Yes.
Sewell left that to me the statement that you can't do that.
Did you discuss it? Or?
Oh, he approved every word I used in the statement.
Oh.
He and Atwell and Clary and I and Ralph Hansen, we did not have legal counsel in those days, much against my will. I had been advocating legal counsel for a long time. But I consulted a couple of law faculty members, as I recall, Frank Remington, one of them.
Harrington, did you?
I did not discuss this with Harrington.
Mm.
But Bill Sewell approved this statement at a staff meeting with four or five of us around his table.
But he didn't want to sign it himself.
No, when he took this position, you may recall, there are items in the newspaper, he was asked how he was going to deal with the protesters and so on, and he indicated that we have a very experienced person here, Dean Koff and so on, and that he was leaving that to me and that he was going to concentrate on academic and curriculum and things of that sort, which was somewhat naive of him, but that's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And he agreed that we had to say, hey, you can't do that, because we pledged to the faculty, and he pledged to the faculty. I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Fleming did first and asked the faculty, you're sure now we may have to call out police, even the National Guard? And the faculty said, we're going to prevent, coercion on this campus. Okay, here are the rules. And then Sewell reiterated that these are the rules, and so long as we have them, I will defend them. This is where we are. And so this statement was made. It was made by me, and I must say, as a good soldier, I had no... there was no need for me to be the lightning rod or to take the heat, except that I volunteered to do it because Chancellor Sewell was new, was very reluctant to start right off issuing this kind of challenge, and yet agreed it had to be done. And so being the kind of duty-oriented person I am, I said, okay, I'll do it.
Would you have liked him to sign it instead?
Well, let me put it this way. Chancellor Fleming always issued the statements the previous 2 years, many times at my suggestion or with my drafting.
Mm-hmm. But
obviously the senior executive officer of the institution would have been more appropriate than the Dean of Student Affairs, but I had no objection to doing it.
Mm.
I felt this was so important that one shouldn't be looking for cover here.
What about the others that were there? What did they think?
They all agreed with the statement.
That you should sign it.
Well, you see, Chancellor Sewell was so new and so reluctant to get involved in this kind of controversy, and so sympathetic to the anti-war protests and so on, as I felt I was too, but that I think that there was an attempt to protect him and not have his first month, his hurling the gauntlet this way.
Hmm.
So, in effect, I stepped into the breach here, and all I did was say, it's my firm belief that a repetition of last February's disruptive activity, similar interviews were held, it's against the interests of all parts of the university, and then I repeat, Chapter 1102, the laws and regulations of states, I said, the faculty on February 23rd, 1967 reaffirmed this policy. The university administration stands ready to enforce these policies.
Mm-hmm.
If any student obstructs scheduled placement, you know, there will be disciplinary action taken, which is what my legal advisors told me, the people I consulted at the law school and so on, was a proper kind way of, you know, you just don't go in and start arresting people. You warn them that this is an unlawful mm-hmm. assembly or that this constitutes a violation of the law, or, and you give them an opportunity mm-hmm. to have due warning and to act accordingly. And that's why that statement was made. Now, obviously, that statement made me the guy to run over if you're a revolutionary.
Yes.
And in that sense, I volunteered to be somewhat expendable, although I wasn't worrying about things like that. I was, you know, we were living kind of day by day. These are not, you know, it's only with hindsight that one looks back on this with, you know, what were your motives, this and that. One, you know, I was doing what I thought my job was.
Well, you were also addressing what you assumed was quite a limited number of students. It was only afterwards
yes.
that it became such a
right.
much larger proportion.
Right. Yes, I was only dealing with those students who were talking about willfully obstructing, willfully violating the faculty rules. And I assumed that that was a very small proportion of people.
Then after that, before the 17th, did you discuss, what did you think about the possibility of not at least using the Commerce Building? I know that was one of the things that was mentioned as that would have been a way out to have used
Well, in you know, in retrospect, the Commerce Building was a bad place. But you have to understand that until you have this happen, it's difficult to believe that it will happen. We had had vigorous protests. Really vigorous protests in which, you know, students would walk a gauntlet to get into an interview of hooting and jeering people. But yet we preserve the integrity of free access. And there had been no violence on any campus, really. In cities, beginning, yeah, but not on any campus.
That's true.
And so my assumption, our assumption, police assumption, so on, was that the most that would happen is that people would go limp and force us to remove them and have them arrested for civil disobedience.
Yeah.
Kind of, again, bearing witness, you see. None of us had calculated that there would be violence. And incidentally, the violence was started by people who attacked the police as they entered. That's what caused the panic and so on. The police were severely outnumbered and did panic, in my view. So, in hindsight, you know, the Commerce was a bad place, and we immediately moved subsequent interviews over to the field house, for that matter, where we could maintain security. But there was still, you know, the need, I guess, to experience what had not been experienced before having that kind of wisdom.
Uh-huh.
You know, one did not assume that students would behave in that way.
You said that you felt the faculty had let the university down by not saying more because they had more contact with the students than you ever had a chance to have in the administration.
That's commented upon in the Scotton report, I believe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How did you go? Did you actually? In fact, I think you said you had tried to get the faculty to.
I can remember. Incidentally, I have some delightful personal notes in longhand from people like Jim Crow and Samuel Merman and people like that after I left telling
me... You
ought
to put them in the file.
Telling me, you know, what respect they had for me and so on. What I had attempted to do back in 66 I had even distributed copies of the Port Huron Statement, which was the founding document of SDS, to members of the university committee, and urged them to get acquainted with what was developing in the country and with the new left and so on, and with some of the demands for student power, on the grounds that ultimately what was being attacked was the integrity of the faculty's authority, not the administration. And, they could run over the dean of students, so what? You know, that the real issue here was, over, the concept of an academic institution and faculty governance and so on. And I found almost no interest in discussing such matters. In fact, my first semester here, I urged Chancellor Fleming and Dean Epstein at a luncheon to form some kind of an association of TAs and give them status as as apprentice faculty and treat them as colleagues, including, having some seminars on teaching effectiveness and developing examinations, how to lead discussions, and master-teacher kind of relationships, on the grounds that they were so many of them were alienated and felt exploited and so on, that if we weren't careful, they would be the source of great difficulty in communicating this disaffection to the students. And was told that, I believe it was Dean Epstein who said that the administration can't interfere with that, that the TAs are department by department, and even the dean can't deal with them as a group. And of course, we know what happened since then.
That's great.
In fact, since this all occurred, people have talked to me privately, like people on the university committee walking away from Bascom Hall and Commerce Building on that day, having seen some. These were very difficult times, and I have a lot of pride in my work, and I work very hard, and I never really had time to do all the things that I wanted to do.
It wasn't actually, I suppose you're, well, in a way it was, but I mean, you could have said at the graduate
That's
school
right.
might have been more.
That's right. So I felt all along that very few people were taking this seriously. Hmm. In fact, since this all occurred, people have talked to me privately, like people on the university committee walking away from Bascom Hall and Commerce Building on that day, having seen some students with rocks and bricks in their hands darting around the buildings, on just went on about their business as though, well, this is not our, not our thing. Deans who went to Rotary that noon, assuming that it wasn't any of their business, kind of thing.
Who went to Rotary?
Well, I don't want to name the names, but I can.
Did Leon Epstein?
I don't think he did, but I know at least one dean who went to Rotary that day with a couple of other people. And it was that was my point when I spoke to Jim Scott, that it was very hard to get this kind of faculty to understand that what was developing here wasn't really an attack on the administration, which they needn't worry about. It was really an attack on the faculty and the faculty's integrity and the faculty's authority and so on. And it's only, a couple of years later that the faculty began to experience that, mm-hmm. with the TA strike and the Afro-American protests and so on, when they began to realize what was going on. So I did feel very much alone in those days, particularly after Fleming left, because I think Fleming had a good education with me as to what all these issues were. And I felt that, particularly my last year, that I stood pretty much alone, and that some people after the Tao demonstration in October, after the violence, so on, some people had a vested interest in letting me stand alone so as not to be tainted by the controversy that resulted from the use of police on campus and so on. Although I was not certainly the one who ordered police to do whatever occurred.
Who would you say that was?
Well, that was a combination of the escalation here in pledging that the campus would not tolerate willful obstruction and disruption, so that we had campus police, later supplemented by city police, the authority of the chancellor's office being the final authority in involving police. I had no final authority to involve police. But again, only in hindsight does one see this as something that, who did this, who did that, because it was a very normal kind of progression of campus police saying, we can't handle a crowd that big. There will be violence if we don't have enough police.
Mm-hmm.
To involving the police, who are not expected to have to do anything.
Yeah.
And they were essentially off-duty traffic cops, turned into stormtroopers by the image makers. The whole thing was a great big tragedy. Let's understand that. There's no doubt in my mind that the people who caused that tragedy were a handful who willfully planned and tried to precipitate that kind of tragedy. And not those who attempted to cope with it, who were not looking for trouble, I assure you, and were the most surprised by it,
mm-hmm,
of anyone.
Evan Stark, I know, came over to Bascom to talk to you all in the midst of it, saying that he would try to, asking you to.
It looked like it was we were about to have the thing blow up, and he indicated to Ralph Hansen that he thought that he could negotiate a peaceful solution, and Ralph stopped the police and brought Stark to my office.
Mm-hmm.
Whereupon he informed Chancellor Sewell, who was a sociology professor, and Evan Stark was a sociology graduate student, that if Sewell would sign a document that there would be no more interviews held on campus by any company or doing business with the government or the war or any government agent and so on, that he would go back and see what he could do.
So it wasn't a compromising.
Which meant Sewell having to resign his job if he would ever do a thing like that. First of all, Sewell had no authority to pledge that there would be no more interviews, that Board of Regents would have overruled him anyway if faculty
did it
too.
Occur to you that he might have done it and resigned his job and just to stop the immediate event?
No. There was no way for anyone of any principle at all to do that, because we were dealing with, in my opinion, a very unstable man who had no authority over the demonstrators and who would have merely ridiculed Sewell and gone about doing what they were going to do anyhow.
This is the end of the tape now.